Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Tradesman International versus John Black. Mr. Kirk.
Okay, please, the court. My name is Jim Kurek, and I'm representing the appellant in this case, Tradesman International. We are asking the court to, there are really two issues on this appeal. One is the court's order granting summary judgment to the defendants, which we are asking this court to reverse. And then the defendants have cross-appealed the court's denial of their motion for attorney's fees, which we are asking this court to affirm. It appears there is a threshold issue in this case of jurisdiction. One of the individual defendants in this case, Mr. Ellis, filed a petition for bankruptcy during the pendency of the case below. And as a consequence, under this circuit's precedent, it appears that a true final judgment may not be entered until such time as the claim against Mr. Ellis is brought to a final conclusion. And then at that point in time, a final judgment would occur. As an alternative basis for jurisdiction, we have asserted that because the district court denied injunctive relief and that denial of injunctive relief is interdependent with the claims and the decision on the summary judgment motion, that the court's summary judgment ruling is still appropriate before this court. There then is the separate issue of this court's jurisdiction as to the cross appeal. And as the appellees have stated, and as we noted in our briefing, if this court were to determine that it does not have jurisdiction to decide the summary judgment issue, then likewise this court would not have jurisdiction to decide the attorney fee issue, which is, as they have acknowledged, derivative of the summary judgment ruling.
But there is a certification under Rule 54 on the attorney fee order, isn't that?
That's correct. There is, although we've cited cases in our brief that indicate you cannot simply use a 54C certification to create jurisdiction where one does not, where it does not otherwise exist.
But the district court's determination on the attorney's fee, there's nothing left for the district court to do on that.
Well, to the extent the claim that currently is stayed due to the bankruptcy against Defendant Ellis is ultimately allowed to go forward, and to the extent there are decisions made by the district court on that, as well as attorney's fees expended, there would still then be arguably a non-final judgment until such time as everything has been fully decided. And it's at that point in time that any request for attorney's fees would then be appropriate.
Well, as far as the district court is concerned, though, it knows all it needs to know. It knew all it needed to know to decide the attorney fee question in your favor.
That's correct.
But if we were to disagree with that, we wouldn't simply order an award of fees. We'd say, in essence, think again, wait until the end of the whole lawsuit, right?
Potentially, yes.
Okay. Why didn't you seek relief from the bankruptcy court, relief from the stay?
Pardon me?
Why did you not seek relief from the bankruptcy court stay?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I cannot address that. I was not counsel for the company in the bankruptcy proceeding.
This is the problem for you. It is the problem for us. It's an easy answer to the jurisdictional problem, and you did nothing about it. And, you know, as you know, and your opponent is saying, that's part of the evidence of this effort to prolong this litigation and impose fees upon them.
Well, quite honestly, Your Honor, we see the filing of that bankruptcy just the other way, that it's an effort to try and prolong the litigation as it relates to us, because now we're having to argue that point.
Okay, then why did you not take the obvious step of asking the bankruptcy court for relief from the stay?
And I do not have an answer for that, Your Honor.
And why did you not ask the district court then for a Rule 54B certification of its summary judgment ruling?
We felt that we had an independent basis for jurisdiction.
Right, but you don't have any answer to Kimbrell against Brown, right?
Correct.
About the bankruptcy issue. Now,
that's
with
correct.
Respect to the injunction question,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me you do have jurisdiction under 1292 for part of the case. question is which parts. What are the grounds upon which you're seeking injunctive relief?
We were seeking injunctive relief for the various violations.
Which?
Okay. I can, if I may, Your Honor. I don't, let me see if I can find the amended complaint. My recollection is that it was not simply limited to the trade secret issue, for example. My recollection under the amended complaint was that the injunctive relief was based on the various violations, the non-compete violation, I believe the trade secret piece, but again, I cannot quickly locate the amendment.
But if we've got jurisdiction, that's it, okay? And it would be limited to those issues. Could we talk about the validity of the non-competes? I think all of them are written in terms of applying to any work done within 25 miles of your client's current work sites.
Yes.
Which a former employee couldn't even know, right?
Well, there is a mechanism where they could find out if they chose to.
They have to ask you.
They could contact tradesmen and ask.
Is that written into the contract?
No.
Have you ever seen such a contract upheld?
Where?
It says you can't work within 25 miles of any of our current work sites, wherever they might be, regardless of where your own work was done, and even if you don't know where they are?
I've not seen it written that way. However, I have seen...
It's not how it's written, but that's what it means, right?
No, I think, yes, but the provision that says a 25-mile radius of anywhere we do work is similar to you can't work with any of our competitors, wherever they may be found.
No, that's entirely different. Would you agree that the individual defendants all were working? Was it all in Indiana?
Initially. And you mean before they left
when
the company?
When they worked for tradesmen, yes.
No, when they worked for tradesmen, they covered some different territories at different points in time.
Well, let's say in the last couple of years.
In the last couple of years, they were primarily in Indiana with a couple of other states.
There were counties in Ohio for one of them?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the company's legitimate interest for prohibiting work, let's say, in Arizona?
To the extent there are two things under the non-compete. One is the within 100 miles of any tradesman office, and tradesman has an office, I believe, in Arizona.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the provisions of the contractor. I'm talking about what legitimate interest the employer has in prohibiting competition by these employees in areas where they did not work at all for you and could have had no goodwill or customer relations.
Because, in particular, if you look at the history of these four individuals, although this tends to be fairly common for tradesmen, when people come on board, they may have very little knowledge of the construction staffing industry. They learn tradesmen's methods. They understand how tradesmen goes after business, et cetera. They know their pricing. So to the extent they're able to take that knowledge and the next day after they leave employment go out and start up an identical company, there's a legitimate interest in protecting that for some period of time.
Do you guys do business? Is there a state where you don't do business?
Not to my knowledge. There may be one or two where there are no offices.
Okay.
But they do it pretty much nationwide.
Okay. Are there countries where you don't do business?
My understanding is we don't do business outside of the United States.
Okay. So if they went to Ontario and used what they had learned about the business generally, would that hurt TMI?
If we are not doing business there, no, it would not.
Uh-huh. And so your idea then is that the employer has a legitimate interest in prohibiting the use of general know-how in the business.
It's more than general know-how.
Trade secrets?
Trade secrets.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, but certainly all of the information about how they do business, how they approach customers, all these individuals have been trained by tradesmen in how to do
that. But those aren't secrets, right? How you do business with your customers.
Trade secrets? No.
Right. So what's the legitimate interest?
Again, the legitimate interest is to the extent we are going to take someone and train them in how we function and how to conduct this business, it is reasonable for us to say, if you choose to leave or we choose to separate you, there's going to be a period of time where you're not going to take all that know-how.
Do Ohio courts recognize, I mean, look, we're not talking here about goodwill, are we?
Well, certainly that's a part of
it. Well, not if you're in an entirely different territory, right?
Not in the sense that individual A would know that client in that territory,
okay.
But in the sense that they would know how tradesmen, they may know who tradesmen does work with in that territory, but they also would know exactly how tradesmen approaches and prices.
But we've agreed those aren't trade secrets.
They're not trade secrets.
Okay,
but you don't need a trade secret.
Do Ohio courts recognize that kind of general know-how, short of a trade secret, without involving direct goodwill with customers, as legitimate and supporting a non-compete?
Yes.
Which cases?
The Raymond case is probably the seminal case in Ohio that deals with the enforceability of non-compete agreements. And it speaks to the types of factors that Ohio courts consider in deciding whether or not there's a protectable interest. The other aspect of Ohio law in this area is that Ohio courts also apply the blue pencil rule. Therefore, in Ohio, to the extent a company is seeking to enforce a non-competition agreement.
So we look to whether the covenant seeks to stifle the inherent skill and experience of the employee. It's one of the factors, right?
Yes.
Is that what you're trying to do here?
No, because they did not have these skills and abilities when they came to work for us. They gained them through their employment with us.
So let me be more specific.
Sure.
Not trade secrets, not goodwill. Ohio cases that say you can prohibit, in essence, general know-how, the use of general know-how learned on the job.
The Ohio cases focus more on can you control competition? Not the subject matter, but the competition itself. Can you say when you leave this employment, you will not work in any type of competitive situation for a period of time? And Ohio courts have consistently said yes, you can control that as long as the restrictions are reasonable.
And which cases say you can do that without trade secrets and without goodwill?
I can't answer that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay. The other, I believe, fundamental issue, and I won't go over the facts because I think the court is well aware of the facts in terms of the different activities these individuals engaged in. Primarily what the district court did was to say, although there was evidence of, in our view, damages, and I can go through those in a moment in some detail, that was not sufficient, and because there was not sufficient evidence of damages, essentially all of the claims had to fail. That was how the district court dealt with all of them. I think the only count that was not addressed that way was the declaratory judgment count, and that's because the court determined the non-compete agreements had expired, and therefore there wasn't any need to address it, and it was rendered moot. In these types of cases, it often is extremely difficult to pinpoint exact damages. You can find individuals have left, they have competed, but being able to demonstrate that competition, that activity, has resulted in some tangible damage is a difficult thing to prove.
Did you ask for a preliminary injunction in this case?
Pardon me?
Did you ask for a preliminary injunction?
No, Your Honor, we chose not to.
That's usually the answer to that argument you just made.
Well, not necessarily if you feel there's already been some economic damage, because when you're seeking a preliminary injunctive relief, you essentially have to say to the court, this cannot be remedied by damage. Therefore, we need an immediate injunction.
Any sensible court knows it's hard to calculate. That's why you have a good chance, if you're otherwise on solid ground, of getting an injunction. But could you address the district court's specific criticisms of your damages approach and show us, direct us, to the most specific damages calculations you provided to the court and to the opposing parties?
Okay. The court essentially said that although we had presented evidence of dollars that the defendants had obtained through other clients that arguably were clients we could recover on, the district court said we did not take those dollar figures and then come up with a profitability analysis based on those numbers. What the court misses is those aren't our numbers. Those are their numbers. You know, we can show that, in essence, around $500,000 of business was done with tradesmen clients that we believe violates the non-compete agreements.
So did you provide an estimate of the approximate profits that you would have gained if you had gotten that business?
No, we did not.
Why isn't that fatal?
Because the issue of what that money would be, the profit on that, is ultimately an issue that has to be discerned from the defendants, not from us. We don't know
what
their...
Your profits?
No, ultimately, I believe that we can ask the district court to make them disgorge their profits from the business that they took.
Did you present that theory to the district court?
That we were looking for recovery based on the yes.
Did you present evidence?
Yes, we gave the court evidence.
Okay, where is that?
It is in the it appears in several places. It's referencing.
How about giving me one place at least?
One place, okay. Let's see. We spoke about it. You're looking for the actual evidence of
yes,
the damage?
Please.
The actual evidence of the damage was in the documents that the defendants produced that indicated the amount of money that they had made from TCR Systems, from, let's see, two other entities that they ran through PLS of Indiana.
I assume you're talking about Stickle Steam and Retrotech?
Yes.
Okay. It's in your appendix at exhibits, or at page 231 and 232. Those are gross numbers.
Yes, and they're their numbers.
Right. So did you do any discovery on their profits?
There was some information
did
that
you,
they...
Well, did you present to the district court any evidence about their profits or about what profits you would have made?
Their gross profits evidence was presented on their profits on those particular
receipts.
Jobs. No.
Okay.
Not on those particular jobs, because we don't know what cost factors they applied.
The opposing parties have referred to our decision in E360 Insight against Spam House Project. I don't know if you're familiar with that case.
I'm not, Your Honor.
They cited it. It essentially is controlling, and it says if all you present is gross revenue information for your damages theory, you lose. It's a case you should be familiar with.
If it were our gross revenue, then I understand that analysis. But it wasn't our gross revenue. It was their gross revenue. And there's no way for us to say this is the we can tell from the information we obtained in discovery how much money they obtained from these clients. We cannot tell what arguable profit they did or did not make on that. Presumptively, if we said to the district court, which we did, they should be required to disgorge $500,000 because that's what they obtained from these clients, they will then say, no, it's not $500,000, it's some lesser number because we had to pay X, Y, and Z.
Go ahead.
Just to be very basic about this, you've got a map on, or not you don't, but... Your opponent has a map on page 9 of their brief of Indiana, listing counties, who was responsible for them. Familiar with that?
Yes.
Tell me how this would work, just very basically, where Were you in, for example, Jasper County? Did you have an or any county, if you can know one that you can refer to, an operation there that that you no longer have? In other words, where you were dealing with clients there?
We did not have, excuse me, an office there. Our office in Illinois was...
Or a client, is what I guess I'm saying, or a contractor.
Any particular, I do not know.
You know any counties where you could give me, I mean, I won't want to kind of go through what happened.
For example, we did work with TCR Systems, and TCR Systems was in a variety of different areas, including some of the areas that they were taking business.
Did any particular type of construction?
In essence, it's very rarely residential. It's mostly commercial construction. I do note my white light has come on. But
we've been asking you a lot of questions.
That's okay.
That's the, I guess, in my case, the royal we, since I've been asking a lot of questions. But with respect to TCR Systems,
mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, when the defendants asked for a list of your work sites where they couldn't compete, you didn't include TCR on that list, did you?
They didn't ask for work sites. They asked for a list of clients.
Protected clients.
Who've
right?
we done work for.
And you didn't list them.
And TCR was inadvertently left off that list, but they were specifically disclosed to them in other aspects of discovery.
So they were supposed to figure out that you made a mistake in the list of protected clients?
No, in fact, they knew we'd made a mistake because two of the defendants acknowledged in deposition that they were well aware TCR Systems was a client of Tradesmen.
But they couldn't rely on your list of protected clients?
That list was inaccurate in that respect.
And they couldn't, you're saying they should not have been able to rely on the list you produced in the litigation?
That's correct.
Okay. The Stickelsteam work, where was that done by them?
My recollection is that was done, I believe, in Arizona. It was another state done by a PLS employee. Although they claimed it was for PLS of Indiana.
You focused also on those two and on RetroTech.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the RetroTech work done by the defendants?
It was in another state as well, out west. A long way from Indiana.
Okay.
And what they attempted to do there was by creating the Indiana entity and then having some type of agreement, which was never provided to us, that allowed for PLS to send employees to do this work. But they claimed it really wasn't being done by PLS because it would have been in violation of the agreement. So instead they claimed it was being done by PLS of Indiana, using exclusively a PLS employee. And then the testimony that we had was that the profit from that, after PLS was paid all of its expenses, the profit went to the Indiana Corporation.
How competitive is this? I mean, is this a practice within the industry of using organizations like yours to provide skilled labor?
It's very competitive. What it essentially does is if I'm a contractor building a project and I need 10 extra carpenters, rather than going out and hiring 10 carpenters for 2 weeks, I go to a company like Tradesmen and say I need 10 carpenters for 2 weeks. They come on board, I pay Tradesmen for them, they're Tradesmen employees. And then when I'm done with them, they leave. If in the interim, some people on another project of mine are free, I call Tradesmen and say, I now only need 5 employees. It gives them that necessary flexibility with skilled tradespeople.
This has been done in the medical profession too, hospitals, you said.
Yeah, I think that this type of... it's beyond what I would term sort of a manpower, unskilled labor type of support, and it's providing very specific skilled laborers because the nature of these projects is that they require that level of skill. And so it is an area that is very competitive because you're looking at contractors who have projects who have enough of them where they're going to need this type of help, and then you need to be able to go in and provide it very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
And I see my red light's on, so at this point, I'll thank the court.
Mr. Vanko.
May it please the Court. If this Court decides to exercise appellate jurisdiction over tradesman's appeal, the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the defendants should be affirmed for three reasons. First, tradesman failed to introduce a genuine issue of material fact as to its entitlement to lost profits damages. Second, tradesman has failed to show that the District Court abused its discretion in refusing to extend the term of expired non-competition agreements. And third, the underlying conduct at issue in this case does not amount to an actionable breach of contract or any tortious activity. In the context of those three reasons that we ask the Court affirm the District Court's judgment, I'd like to specifically respond to the points that the Court has raised today through its questions and that counsel has raised in his argument. The Court asked about jurisdiction over the injunction piece of this case. Judge Hamilton, I think you had indicated that you believed that the Court had jurisdiction over the injunction question under 1292A1. We have briefed this issue extensively, and we don't necessarily feel that appellate jurisdiction is appropriate under 1292A1 because there hasn't been a denial of the entire injunctive relief that tradesmen has requested. The circuit law is not particularly clear as to what types of injunctions or denials of injunctions qualify for immediate appeal under 1292A1. But we think, based on Albert versus TransUnion, that given the fact that the injunctive relief currently sought below against one other defendant is identical to what is here on appeal, that this is actually not an appropriate case for jurisdiction under 1292A1. There's also a separate issue under Carson versus American Brands, which is the Supreme Court's case that we've cited in our briefing. And we do not believe that tradesman has met the standard of Carson versus American Brands to establish jurisdiction in this court. I'd like to address Judge Hamilton's question about the validity of the non-compete agreements. You had asked about the 25-mile services restriction, which is found in Part 1C of each of the non-compete agreements. I think it's helpful for this court to understand a little bit more about how this industry works. A customer, for instance, like TCR, would be a customer of a staffing company. TCR is actually a sheet metal fabrication shop. So when TCR comes to a staffing company like Professional Labor and says, we need skilled labor, it can really, PLS could supply skilled labor in one of two ways. It could supply shop employees to work on site at TCR systems. But it could also take those skilled labor employees and go to a TCR customer. And a TCR customer may be located in Western Illinois. It could be an entirely different state. So a tradesman employee or a PLS employee could work for a customer, but it could also work for a customer's customer on site. And that's where the provision in Section 1C becomes really indeterminate and impossible to understand what the scope is, because there's no real way for an employee, leave aside the defendants, but any employee of tradesmen, to know where each of those customers are that they're providing services to, or each of those customers' customers are. And in this case, for instance, TCR Systems worked with Monsanto. Monsanto has 15 or 20 different locations throughout the state of Illinois. Some of them are nowhere near Decatur, where TCR Systems is based. There's no evidence in the record of where TCR Systems was providing its services. There's no indication in the record that Professional Labor Support was working within 25 miles of anywhere where tradesman was providing its services. There's not one single fact. And part of the problem in this case about the interpretation of these agreements is that tradesman thinks it's okay to just say, well, they were a known tradesman client or a known tradesman customer and you were working with them. That's not what the non-competes actually prohibit. They have to be a customer, or it has to be work within one of three geographic regions. And there's no evidence in the record that at any time during anyone's non-compete agreement, anybody was working within a particular restricted region for a tradesman customer.
Do I understand it then that this is not just for construction projects, but existing manufacturing that runs short of particular tradespeople?
Correct. In TCR systems, for instance, there would be millwrights, which would be a skilled trade. TCR may want to engage a staffing company to supply local employees to work on-site at the contractor in their shop, for instance. It doesn't need to be a construction project off-site. So the work varies. It varies by location, and it varies by where that the contractor that may engage us has work, whether it's a work that necessitates travel or is, in fact, local.
Could you address, Mr. Vanko, this issue about whether the Ohio law recognizes a protectable interest for an employer in a non-compete when there are no trade secrets involved and no goodwill or you're not in the employee's former territory?
Those are the two interests that I'm aware of that Ohio courts recognize. I do know that the Raymond case, which is the seminal decision that both counsel, I think, have cited, does instruct courts to consider a variety of factors. It's not clear from those factors which ones are employer-friendly, which ones are employee-friendly. It appears as though what Ohio courts do, like many other courts, is say, we need to assess the reasonableness based on the totality of the circumstances. For instance, was there some specialized, highly specialized training that was provided to employees? In this case, the testimony was unrebutted that the training was provided was about a five-day general sales presentation on how to sell. There was nothing indicating that it was special or unique to tradesmen or to this particular industry. I'm not aware of an Ohio case that holds that general training that's provided to an ordinary sales employee is itself a protectable interest.
Are there any Ohio cases that specifically reject that theory?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. And I think you need to look at the Raymond case to look at the factors that court instructs lower courts to consider, and it goes into the overall mix of whether there's a protectable interest.
Though under Raymond, I don't know how an employee is supposed to, a departing employee is supposed to know what's allowed and what's not.
Well, one of the and tradesmen's interpretation in their response to that question or a similar question was that Ohio law allows for them to control competition. No, it doesn't. Ohio law says that a non-compete that is reasonable and is narrowly tailored to a protectable interest can be enforced. It doesn't say that an employer is allowed to control competition. There's no case that says that. And in this case, we have argued, and we actually moved for partial summary judgment in the district court back in February, that the non-competes were unenforceable on their face. That argument wasn't really front and center at the time we moved for summary judgment in June because the non-competes had expired. The remedy was really the focus of our argument on summary judgment. And I'd like to turn to that issue, the remedy, both profits and injunctive relief, and address some of the responses to questions that tradesmen offered the court. I believe, Judge Hamilton, you asked whether the disgorgement of profits was something that was sought by tradesmen. It wasn't. The Rule 26 disclosures in this case indicated that tradesmen was seeking lost profits. Lost profits is not the same as disgorgement of profits. Lost profits indicates that those are sales tradesmen would have made based on the costs tradesmen would have incurred. There was no evidence of disgorgement of profits. Now, tradesmen never asked for our costs related to any work that we performed for any customer. Now, they could have done that. They never asked for it. But I'm not even sure that's really the correct question, because presumably tradesmen knows what its costs would have been to supply that labor that they contend was wrongfully serviced by professional labor support. For instance, if we send a millwright out to TCR Systems and we bill that employee out at $15 an hour, that may not be the same as tradesmen. Tradesmen may bill that employee out lower. It may bill them higher. I don't know. But it's their obligation to provide us what their direct selling expenses would have been in addition to allocated overhead that it would have cost them to produce those sales. There's one fundamental fact that was really missing, and it crystallizes this whole problem with damages. Tradesmen had no operations in central Illinois when my clients moved and started professional labor support. The overwhelming majority of the clients that we worked for were based in Illinois. We supplied local labor out of a local field office. For tradesmen to do that work, they would have needed to set up an office, or at least we believe they would have needed to set up an office. Now, that entails a whole separate set of costs that were never disclosed to us and that the court would have needed to consider when determining overall profits. It would have been the cost of finding a new field office, leasing.
What is the purpose or the function of the office? It seems to me that most of this is simply communication as opposed to a presence.
I asked that of Tradesman's 30B6 witness during his deposition, and he admitted, and it was very consistent with what our clients testified to as well, the office gives you a local presence to market to potential customers and, more importantly, to recruit skilled labor. Now, a client like TCR Systems, for instance, is going to want, on occasion, locally supplied labor. That's what they testified to in this case. The distinction, Judge Tinder, is that if you're supplying that labor out of a different office, say it's in Wisconsin or if it's in Indiana where Tradesman was located, you would have to pay, or the client really would have to pay, a per diem. A per diem basically means you have to pay for them to their travel and their lodging and their meals overnight. And when you start adding up the sheer volume of hours, even if that per diem is $30 a day, it can actually be very, very expensive, and it's not really competitive. So a local field office is very important. It's why Tradesman has 80-some field offices. So I think that the fact that Tradesman had never explored working in central Illinois, they would have had to establish a field office in Illinois, adds a whole other layer to cost that they completely ignored at the district court level. Now, for instance, our clients were not getting paid. They paid themselves towards the end of 2010, but presumably if Tradesman's going to open a field office, it's going to have to hire an operations manager, a sales manager, an accounting manager, staff, a recruiter. That's real money that they would have had to expend to develop this entire market. And they never introduced any kind of evidence as to what those costs would have been. They take us to task a little bit in the briefing for suggesting that we were going to require them to get an expert witness. We're not asking them to get an expert witness. What we're asking them is to provide us data and information from people knowledgeable within Tradesmen as to what it would have cost you to replicate what PLS was doing outside the non-compete territory. They never did that. And the best evidence of this is if you look at the Rule 26 disclosures, there's no witness that Tradesmen ever identified at any time in this case that was knowledgeable to testify on damages. And that raises the question of, if this court were to remand, what's a trial before Magistrate Judge Bernthal going to look like? You still don't have a number. You don't have any indication of what Tradesman wants. You don't have a range of numbers. You don't have a basis for lost profits. You don't even have a theory for lost profits. Tradesman says today, for the first time, in all the briefing that's been submitted in this case, they want to disgorge our profits. It's never been disclosed before. So I don't know what Judge Bernthal would do with the documents that Tradesman has produced to come up with a theory of lost profits in this case. And that's really the fundamental problem, is we got to the end of this case, and Tradesman never attempted to prove what its damages were. Now, on the issue of the injunction, because if this court is to hear the appeal and decide the appeal on the merits, the injunction that Tradesman requests is essentially an extension of the non-compete agreements for a period of 18 months from whatever date the court entered an order in Tradesman's favor. Tradesman never moved for preliminary injunctive relief. We don't dispute the general black letter principle that in some circumstances, not present in this case, but in some circumstances, a non-compete may be able to extend beyond the period using the start date as the termination of employment. But in all the cases that we have seen in Ohio, Tradesman doesn't cite any of them in their briefs, in each of those cases, the employer actively moved for a preliminary injunction. And that makes sense. If you wait until the end of the case to request injunctive relief, there's a notion of latches or waiver or abandonment. It's an equitable doctrine. It's an equitable remedy. They should not be allowed to sit for what amounted to a year and a half of litigation, never seek to enforce the non-compete agreements, wait until PLS is an established entity employing skilled tradespeople, building a business in a completely separate market, and then say, now let's start the non-compete agreement. I'm not aware of any Ohio cases that would allow for an extension in a circumstance like that. If the court would permit, I'd like to now turn to the issue of the cross appeal.
Could you just give me a little information? What's the status of the Ryan Ellis bankruptcy? This claim, I assume, is still pending?
It is. I have filed an appearance in that case only on behalf of professional labor support. I don't represent Mr. Ellis in that case, but I do know the status. The status is that Mr. Ellis was named in an adversary proceeding the tradesman filed. The basis, I don't understand exactly what the basis is, but it appears to be that tradesman contends that Mr. Ellis improperly disposed of professional labor support property at some point in time, that therefore they're objecting to his discharge and pursuing an adversary complaint against him. He's answered that complaint. He obtained new counsel recently. It's pending before Judge Metz. In my understanding, I had heard recently that Judge Metz may be retiring, and I don't...
It's true.
Okay. And I don't know if the case is being held in abeyance because of that, but nothing has happened in that case in at least a couple of months.
But it's in the Southern District of Indiana?
It's in the Southern District of Indiana. In that case, tradesman is trying to purchase and become a member of professional labor support because Mr. Ellis's membership interest in professional labor support is now part of the bankruptcy estate.
And Ellis formed PLS of Indiana after he filed the bankruptcy, is that correct?
He did, and Your Honor needs to understand what was occurring at this time. At this time in November, December 2010, professional labor support was losing money but growing, and it attracted outside investors. And those investors were aware that Mr. Ellis's non-compete, it was expiring. We were trying to be very careful in separating the ownership and the management of the company. Mr. Ellis's non-compete was only 1 year. The other defendants had 18-month non-competes. So Mr. Ellis, with this new investor, set up a new entity. They moved back to Indiana. He dissociated himself entirely from professional labor support and has not held any membership interest or been employed in any regard by professional labor support since January. And that's still the case. Now that the non-competes have expired, the two companies do undertake some joint marketing efforts. They have the same website, for instance. But while the non-competes of the other defendants were in place, there was a very clear and concerted effort to make sure there was no overlap. Now, the issue that counsel points out in his argument is that, well, for two jobs, one was in Oklahoma, that was Retrotech, one was in Arizona, that was Stickle Steam, you used an employee of PLS. It was actually a commissioned sales agent who lives out in Arizona, and there was a specific engagement where PLS essentially said to Mr. Ellis, you can use that sales agent for this limited purpose, but we can't have any interest in that business. So all profit went to professional labor support of Indiana with those two jobs. Now, they make vague allegations or arguments in their briefs about how this was some ruse or artifice of PLS of Indiana. It wasn't. We were trying to be extremely careful when Mr. Ellis's non-compete expired. They would have you believe that, well, he's really bound until the last individual's non-compete expires because he was somehow associated with them. In order for them to do that, what they really need to show, and they didn't try to do either one, they need to show that PLS of Indiana was an alter ego of professional labor support. They never tried to do that. Or they need to show that the other defendants were engaged in work that would have otherwise been barred by the non-compete agreements. And they never tried to do that either. So we think this issue of Mr. Ellis's work in Indiana, while some of the other defendants' non-competes hadn't expired, is just sort of a fact that sounds good on paper, but when you drill down to it, it has no merit whatsoever.
Mr. Vanko, you've talked about how careful your clients were to try to comply with these obligations, but I'm troubled by the evidence of the emails they sent themselves with tradesmen's information.
Right.
While they were still working.
Right. And we would acknowledge those are the worst facts in the case for us. That was one defendant who sent several emails to himself. There was one, actually, I think, that went to Mr. Black that contained documents or information that were presumably developed or made available to them at Tradesman. But there's one critical problem with Tradesman's theory that amounts to a tort or some other actionable conduct. At no point in this case did they ever establish that those documents were confidential. Now, if you look at their summary judgment response, and this is Statement of Material Facts number 250 to 264, that was the point in time where they brought these emails to the district court's attention. And they never established through any evidence of their own, of our folks, that was information that was confidential. Some of the documents are just intuitively not confidential. But as to illustrate their complete failure of proof on these issues, they never asked our clients in their depositions whether they considered those documents to be confidential. Not one time in four depositions did they ever ask anyone, did you think that this outdated district manager compensation plan was confidential to Tradesmen? Never asked them. Now, on the Dun and Bradstreet reports, there's more evidence on this, because that was something that was identified very late in March of 2011 as a trade secret of Tradesmen. And those are lists that were commercial lists that were purchased by Tradesmen. We purchased the same thing when we obtained a subscription to Dun and Bradstreet after PLS started. There were virtually no efforts, if any, to keep this information secret by Tradesmen. And the deposition testimony of Tradesmen's 30B6 witness, of Mr. Walker's deposition, indicates that they did virtually nothing to keep these commercial lists secret. Now, the best evidence, Judge Hamilton, of how Tradesmen views these emails is that the easiest way to pursue that claim is to argue and to show to the district court that violated the non-disclosure clause of the employment agreements. They abandoned that issue in the district court, which I think is the best evidence that you're going to find that they didn't believe that they had a colorable claim that those documents were, in fact, confidential. So if that answers Your Honor's question, I know I only have a few minutes left. The cross-appeal, we contend that the district court applied the wrong standard on the attorney's fee question under Section 5.1 of the Illinois Trade Secrets Act. This allows for defense fee shifting if a claim of misappropriation is made in bad faith. I don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm going to be very brief. The trade secrets in this case were the Dun & Bradstreet reports. The district court did not need to reach the question of whether those actually amounted to a legal trade secret because Tradesmen didn't have a remedy. That may pose an issue because if this court decides that the standard was not appropriate, it may say to the district court, you first need to decide whether those documents are a legal trade secret or not. But there's a troubling aspect of this case that the court should be aware of. In their complaint, it's paragraphs 51 and 56 of the complaint, Tradesmen alleged that professional labor support or certain of the defendants used trade secrets to solicit TCR systems. That was the core allegation. At no point did they ever establish that TCR systems was even on the Dun & Bradstreet reports, meaning they could not have believed in that allegation at the time the complaint was filed if that allegation was true. TCR systems was in a completely different area, and they would not have been part of the trade secrets that were identified in this case. I know I'm out of time. I would stand on my brief for the remainder of the cross-appeal issue.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.